traitor. It really creates a crisis.
Mary Catherine Nagle and Matt Lone Bear, again, our condolences on the finding the body of Olivia Lone Bear. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.
Hello, KBOO listeners. Turn in Friday nights from 6 to 7 p.m. for Bread and Roses. This collective has been on air since 1978, making it the longest-running feminist news and public affairs radio show in the country. You can find Bread and Roses on KBOO's website, kboo.fm/breadandroses, or on Facebook at KBOO Bread and Roses Radio. We hope you tune in.
This is KBOO Portland. The time now is 8 o'clock, and coming up next on Positively Revolting, Ani speaks with Sean Tenney of the Oregon Physicians for Social Responsibility and takes your calls.
I'm 50 years old.
KBOO Community Radio is 50. We are celebrating our birthday with a big street fair and party on August 11th from noon to 10 p.m. here at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland. We'll be broadcasting live bands all day and an open house celebrating 50 years of KBOO. There will be a reunion from 2 to 5 during the street party for folks looking to see KBOO volunteers from other eras. So save the date, Saturday, August 11th, to celebrate 50 years of KBOO with your community radio station, KBOO Portland.
What would you have instead?
This is it.
A time when every second, every day, when every action, every thought will tell the world how you cast your vote.
And good morning, good morning. It's just about 3 minutes after 8 in the morning, and you are tuned to your community radio station, KBOO Portland. You are listening to Positively Revolting, and I'm Ani. This morning, we have the pleasure of speaking with Sean Tenney. He's the Associate Director of Oregon Physicians for Social Responsibility, also known as Oregon PSR. And we'll be talking about stopping nuclear proliferation, the upcoming actions to remember the anniversary of the horrific bombings of Hiroshima and Nagasaki by the U.S., and oh, so much more. Thank you, Sean, for joining us this morning.
Thank you so much, Ani, for having me on.
Absolutely. So before we really launch into that, I also want folks to know, if you haven't heard, on the 4th of August, that's Saturday, we call that tomorrow, Patriot Prayer has announced a gathering of the alt-right, of white supremacists, and other kind of wretched characters. Let's just say that. To Portland, and that is going to be in the morning. There is a huge response and counter-demonstration planned. You can find out more information about those really by a lot of different means, but you can find out about Pop Mob, Popular Mobilization, one of the counter demonstrations that KABU is co-sponsoring. You can find out more about that gathering in response in particular on the right side of KABU's homepage, kboo.fm. Check out the calendar listings for community events, and you can find out all the details for Pop Mob. I just wanted to put that out there first. There's a lot of other folks organizing counter demonstrations too. Be aware of what's happening. And yeah, that's what I want to say about that. So back to the rest of the show. There's so much going on, Sean. We are living in very active, busy, and kind of terrifying times. So thank you for taking a moment out of your day to be with us and be with our listeners and let us know what's going on from your end of the spectrum of activism in Portland. So next week, we are looking at a couple of significant anniversaries in world history, and that is the use of atomic weapons, the dropping of atomic bombs on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. And that was 73 years ago. And your organization, Oregon Physicians for Social Responsibility, has commemorated these anniversaries for quite some time now. Let's start our conversation there. On Monday, August 6th, marks the 73rd anniversary of the bombing of Hiroshima.
Correct.
And in those two bombings, on the 6th and then on August 9th, in the bombing of Nagasaki, over 200,000 people were killed at that time, not to mention the many more people that have been affected or who have died because of the radiation after the fact. But 200,000 people were killed in these bombing attacks perpetrated by the U.S. towards what was the end of World War II. First of all, that's just mind-blowing. We can talk about the bombing and why it was done as well, but I want to first start off with the commemoration and action that's happening on Monday. Can you give our listeners an idea of what's going on?
Sure. Well, first, I would just like to invite all of the KABU listeners listening today to join us on Monday. That's August 6th. That is the anniversary of the bombing of Hiroshima. We'll be at the Japanese American Historical Plaza, which is down on the Portland waterfront at Cooch and Northwest Nido Parkway. The event this year is called Facing America's Nuclear Legacy: Hiroshima, Nagasaki, and the Pacific Islands. So this year, we have done an annual commemoration around the anniversaries of Hiroshima and Nagasaki for many years to sort of educate Portlanders on what's happening on the nuclear weapons front and how they can get involved and how they can take concrete actions for nuclear weapons abolition. So this year, we've also kind of brought in another perspective that we think is important to share with our audience, which is that of the Pacific Islanders. So for many years, all through the Cold War, nuclear weapons were tested in the Pacific Islands. This led to a lot of forced displacement, serious health problems, genetic abnormalities, and things that persist to this day. So we really wanted to bring in that perspective and talk a bit about the sort of lasting legacy of America's nuclear weapons beyond the lives that were lost at Hiroshima and Nagasaki, including in the years after the bombings, but also all through the Cold War. Oftentimes in the nuclear weapons abolition field, we talk about the toxic cycle of nuclear weapons. So acknowledging that from the time radioactive materials are first brought out of the earth, people start to die, not only through the conflict that spreads in those regions where the radioactive material is mined, which generally tend to be poorer indigenous countries. So people start dying as soon as we pull it out of the ground, even if the bombs are never used. They're incredibly expensive. There's a plan to spend $1.3 trillion over the next decades on nuclear weapons upgrades. Of course, from our perspective, these morally unacceptable weapons, there's a lot better use we could put $1 trillion to. And, you know, we could
pretty much anything,
you know, other than making weapons that in a best case scenario we never use.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Right.
And so let's Well, there's so much there, and we only have an hour. So let's figure out. We have this legacy, right? And we were talking right before the mics went on about sort of the beginning of this nuclear legacy in this country and the dropping of those bombs through a historic lens. It's hard to... First of all, it's hard to imagine somebody making the decision to do something so horrific. And I know that throughout my life, I've often heard the justification, yeah, but we had to kill people to save people. If we didn't use these horrifying weapons, the war would have just slagged on for a lot longer and a lot more U.S. civilian service folk would have been killed. And so, you know, this was just what the U.S. had to do to try to bring an end to that war. Now we understand through some documents that have surfaced since and that what is more to the case is the war was within a very close time, days or weeks, of actually coming to an end. And that, in fact, the U.S. decided that it had to drop these bombs more as a show of force and a demonstration of this new weapon, the likes of which the world had never really seen, really at all, now used in battle. So you can see the devastating effects on an urban center, on the civilian population. And it was basically used as the largest possible deterrent to any opposition to the U.S. hegemony. What do you say about that?
Well, I mean, I agree with pretty much everything you just said there. I mean, I think that is the mythology of nuclear weapons. It's often referred to as a necessary evil. I would say that it is indeed evil. I would say that the historical record proves that it was in no means necessary. The war was winding down. Japan had already made formal overtures of surrender. They didn't want the bombs dropped, obviously. They didn't understand, really, I think, the full scope. And I think there was a lot of people were under the opinion that no government would do this, would do something so horrific, commit such a brazen act of a brazen war crime, yeah, essentially, in targeting these civilian populations. And I think it's important to remember that nuclear weapons are not designed for combat. They're designed to target civilian population centers. They're designed to kill civilians.
An excellent point.
Right. And I think that's oftentimes lost in it, where these weapons are developed, you know, again, to the tune of trillions of dollars. And you know, again, it's kind of the best case scenario is we mothball them and we never use them. The worst case scenario, of course, is, you know, global annihilation, the loss of all, you know, human life, or the loss of human civilization, certainly. And that's the most likely result of even a limited, so-called limited nuclear conflict. So absolutely, you know, from my perspective and the perspective of Oregon PSR, these weapons are just a morally unacceptable technology. They should have never been developed. They weren't necessary to end the war. They were, you know, rather than being used to really end the war with Japan, they were really being used to show the Soviet Union that we had developed this new weapon and that we were now the sort of big kids on the block. So it was very much a way to sort of further U.S. military hegemony all across the world. And we've seen that in the intervening years through the Cold War and everything. And now we're dealing with a situation now where we have, you know, thousands of these weapons around the world. We see the threat of nuclear proliferation. They're spreading to more and more countries. North Korea and other places are getting these weapons. So it's imperative, I think, to do everything we can, both as citizens and to press on our elected representatives to do everything within their power to cut funding for these weapons, to start to decommission them, and to finally move our species out from underneath the shadow of nuclear weapons that's been hanging over us for the last 73 years.
Absolutely. I could not agree more with what you've just said. I remember I just had my 52nd birthday a couple weeks ago.
Happy birthday.
Thanks. I grew up in the shadow of Reagan, right? I was 14 when he was inaugurated. And that, you know, basically being 16 and seeing that we were at 2 minutes or 3 minutes to midnight, that there were nuclear submarines found off the coast of Puget Sound, and we had heard that Portland was probably the third target on the West Coast for nuclear weaponry during the height of the Cold War in the early 80s under Reagan. I know that for 6-7 years of my life, I had nightmares every night about what that would be, about the flash, about living in a nuclear age, and was part of a group of teenagers that actually gave testimony to the Portland City Council to try to have Portland declared a nuclear-free zone, which eventually we did. And the idea, you know, and then, oh, you know, things happened, and the Berlin Wall fell, and the Cold War kind of ended, and you know, we live in a better world, right? And I, somewhere in my 20s, stopped having those nightmares. I was pretty happy. Seemed like nuclear annihilation wasn't one of those things I really had to think about much anymore. Over the last several years, I realized, A, I was naive, and happily distracted as a 20-year-old doing other things with my life. And now, looking at the saber rattling that has gone on in this last year, in particular with Trump, I'm realizing how close we are again to this brink of devastation as the Union of Concerned Scientists advance the doomsday clock closer, in fact, to midnight than it had been since the 50s. Superseding my nightmares during the Reagan time, right? To see this cycle reemerge after a 30-year hiatus of public attention. I'm wondering what challenges you're having, what successes you're having in actually getting people's ear at this point. Are people like, oh, nukes, yeah, we don't have to, you know, that's old news, right? No one, we don't really talk about nukes anymore.
Yeah, you know, and I this is a sad reflection, I think, of where we are as a culture today. But I think, you know, obviously nuclear weapons are one of the gravest existential threats. They're one of the things that's, you know, very likely to wipe out human civilization of all of the other problems. But sadly, I think one of the reasons that for a lot of folks, nuclear weapons are kind of on the back burner is because there are so many other pressing issues. You know, from climate change to institutional racism and institutional misogyny and all the other things that our country faces and the world faces, a sort of resurgence of right-wing ideology and the whole sort of idiocy of the Trump administration and this desire to spread falsehood and fear and all these other things. So I think there are so many problems that a lot of people forgot about the threat that nuclear weapons face. And to me, the great danger in that is if you forget that a threat is there, it sneaks up on you. Yeah. And when I say a threat sneaking up on you, I'm talking about the loss of human civilization. I'm talking about billions dead.
Yeah.
So I think it's important for people to re-engage with the nuclear weapons abolition movement, to take action, to do things like come to our event on August 6th down at the Portland waterfront, to learn more about nuclear weapons and get involved. And certainly as an organization, Oregon PSR is very involved in the nuclear weapons abolition movement. We've been really pushing Oregon's elected representatives, considering there's not a whole lot that we can do at the national level under this administration. We have been quite successful in pushing Oregon's elected representatives to take really meaningful action for nuclear weapons abolition. So we've got people like Earl Blumenauer and Jeff Merkley really taking action, and I would say being some of the most progressive voices for nuclear weapons abolition in the American government. Not enough. They should certainly be doing a lot more. You know, and again, we're talking not only an existential threat to humanity, but we're also talking about trillions of dollars. So a lot of the conversations that I hear about, oh, well, we can't provide decent health care for Americans. We can't provide affordable right. education for Americans. We can't house Americans. To me, that's outrageous, considering that we're spending trillions of dollars on a weapon that we hope we never use.
Right. And that if we do use it, there goes the planet.
Exactly.
And you know, our lives as we know them. I want to invite our listeners to join us. 503 231-8187 is the number to call this morning. You can join in this conversation. I'm Ani. I'm talking with Sean Tenney. He is the Associate Director of Oregon Physicians for Social Responsibility. We're talking about the commemoration of the bombings in Hiroshima and Nagasaki, the anniversary of which is coming up next week. I'll get all my tenses together here in a second. And I also want you to know that you can follow along Positively Revolting throughout the week on Facebook. You can find our page Positively Revolting in the Twitterverse. You can find us at Positive Revolt. And also to let you know, coming up at 9 o'clock this morning, Pacific Underground will be on the air, and they get personal with T. New, owner of Project Object. They're talking about her family's hardships as refugees in America and her experience running a small business. At 10 o'clock, Valley Views talks with the co-founder of the Corvallis chapter of Surge, that's Showing Up for Racial Justice. At 10:15, it's Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein from KPFA. At 11 o'clock, it's Radio Geekly. Radio Geekly's discussion this month revolves around non-binary characters in geekdom. All of these KABU programs are made possible with your support. Please, if you are not a member yet, you can take care of that embarrassing problem by just going to kboo.fm and hitting the donate button. Support your local independent media, because if you don't, who will, right? And then know that your support funds important conversations like the one we're having this morning with Sean. Again, Sean, thank you so much for being with us this morning.
Thank you, Ani. I appreciate it.
So that number again to call is 503-231-8187. And I just want to talk one moment about the banning of nuclear weapons. I mean, my God, talk about an idea whose time has come. Can we talk about the legislation that,
Absolutely. So last year, there was some, I would consider some of the most significant advances on actually putting teeth to some sort of legislation or international agreements, and that was the passage of the United Nations, sometimes called the humanitarian ban, but the Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons, which passed the UN last year. Basically, what this says is that the vast majority of the peoples of the world acknowledge that nuclear weapons are unacceptable. Most of the world's countries have signed on to this, and the few nuclear armed nations, the 9 nuclear armed nations so far, have not lived up to their responsibility to the international community. I think that's really what it comes down to, is the world acknowledges that these weapons are an existential threat. The governments that make and sell these weapons continue to develop them, continue to spend, you know, so much money on developing these weapons, imperiling the whole rest of the world. So what the UN ban treaty does is ask those governments to take their moral responsibility. Of course, this it really provides a sort of legal framework for the abolition movement going forward. And it gives us a really clear set of principles and a clear set of guidelines for how nuclear abolition would really work. So I think it's a absolutely astounding success at the United Nations. Of course, the problem is getting those countries who so far are not living up to their moral responsibility, including the United States, to actually live up to I would say their responsibility to humanity. We will continue to pressure our government, our elected representatives here in Oregon, as well as in the executive branch and beyond, to take a hard look at this, to live up to our international responsibilities as outlined in the UN Nuclear Weapons Ban Treaty.
Excellent. And well, let's go ahead and talk to some of our listeners. Good morning, Lou. You're on the air.
Good morning. How are you?
Doing well.
Good topic, good timing for the memorial from the bombings in Japan. I'm curious if PSR at Portland State, we've talked to in the past, both Rudy Nussbaum and Catherine Thomason.
Oh, great.
Who is Oregon and national, I don't know if she's still in D.C., PSR manager, coordinator, about corporations that manufacture nuclear weapons. It seems like Lockheed Martin is one, but I'm not sure if that's true. Are there 2 or 3 main corporations that make them?
Yeah, you know, there's a handful of corporations that sort of have their fingers in the nuclear weapons pie, and those are the sort of big, I think, for anyone who who's well educated in sort of the war industry. These are a lot of the sort of common criminals. We're talking about General Electric, General Dynamics, Boeing, Raytheon, Gulfstream Aerospace, and of course they get funding from the big banks, Bank of America, Wells Fargo, these kind of things. So there's the big corporations, and then there are also the big financial institutions that provide a lot of the funding and make money off of the investments in nuclear weapons. So one of the things that we also advocate for is divestment from nuclear weapons, any corporation that is making money off of these, again, morally unacceptable technologies. There's a really great report called Don't Bank on the Bomb, and I think you can find that at don'tbankonthebomb.com, and that's a great way to find out which financial institutions are investing in nuclear weapons and divest from them.
So in terms of acting locally and thinking globally against nuclear war and nuclear weapons, of the maybe 10 banks and corporations you mentioned for the Northwest, is there like a local college, maybe Reed or a different school in Washington State, that's either targeting Boeing or Wells Fargo in particular?
You know, I'm not sure locally exactly what's happening in terms of in Oregon or Washington. We are sort of part of this larger divestment campaign of the Don't Bank on the Bomb. There have been some concerted efforts around that, but I don't think that it's really been formalized by Reed or another big institution, at least as far as I know. That's certainly something that we would encourage, you know, not only individuals, but certainly larger institutions, educational institutions, corporations themselves. You know, I think a lot of this comes to, putting pressure on companies to take responsibility for society, which, you know, we're Oregon Physicians for Social Responsibility. So social responsibility is a big part of what we are advocating for. And I think divesting from nuclear weapons and getting out of that, that field of death and destruction and annihilation is something that anybody can do and any corporation can do. They just have to have the personal responsibility, the corporate responsibility, and I think the morality to do the right thing.
Sure. Well, I think the thought would be, since it seems like it's true at PSU, and I believe that you mentioned that nuclear weapons and nuclear war, despite being extremely high monetary cost to taxpayers, also has this problem similar, if perhaps even greater, than global warming, which is wiping the people on the planet out. I'm thinking in terms of Boeing and Wells Fargo trying to tie into other campaigns, that because Boeing's local, basically, and because Wells Fargo is like the most corrupt bank there is, basically, and the target of several other campaigns on different issues, that might be two good coalition targets. My other question was about, it sounded like you referenced Truman's initial decision to bomb Hiroshima and Nagasaki, and there was a class at PSU. We met one of our best organizers in that class. It was in the history department, and it was by a Republican older teacher who had personally fought in World War II against the Japanese. And he was totally, totally upset with Howard Zinn and the other revisionist, quote-unquote, historians who said that it was a demonstration bombing specifically to challenge Russia at that point. I don't believe you all mentioned Russia as a country today. Against either development or expansion, or at that point the USSR's global politics, basically, and that by physically removing 200,000 or more civilians in those two cities, that was a demonstration bombing to show, allegedly, Russia that right, they shouldn't mess around with the United States.
Yep.
You may have other callers, so I'll let you do that.
Thanks. Yep, we did cover that earlier. Thanks, Lou, for your call.
Thanks, Lou.
And a lot of good points. Let's go ahead and talk to George. Good morning, George. You're on the air.
Hey, Annie. I've been following this, and I'm beginning to wonder if among the divestments we should consider is divesting from capitalism, because if we don't, I have the feeling that these kinds of powerful corporate interests allied with powerful political interests, which say, well, let's destroy a portion of the earth that is competing with us right now. Although the message seems to be getting out that kind of thing is going to lead to the end of most of civilization in the Northern Hemisphere, and maybe in the southern hemisphere too. But I don't know, as long as we keep capital as our master, can we really get out of this kind of cycle? I'll hang up. I want to listen to what you have to say about that. Okay.
All right. Thanks very much, George.
Well, I would certainly say that capitalism is very much a threat to humanity, certainly in the sort of late stage capitalism that we are in right now. And I want to be very clear that I think that one of the primary reasons that nuclear weapons exist is because people make money on them.
Yeah.
And we wouldn't be having this conversation about, $1 trillion, $1.3 trillion over the next decade, unless somebody who is already quite rich were getting even richer. And that's the primary reason we're doing them. It's not about security. It's not about keeping us safe. It's not about protecting our civilization. Far from it. In fact, it's the opposite of that. It's imperiling our civilization at the core so that somebody can make money. And again, this is a problem with capitalism in general, is if your primary motive is individual profit, then individual profit and social responsibility don't always go together that well. I don't think it's impossible for them to go together. I think there are certain ways that that it could work together, but I think we've seen from just reality all around the world that it is not working. Or perhaps even more insidious, it is working as it's designed.
As it's designed.
It was designed.
Exactly.
It was designed to enrich a small group of people at the expense of the working class and the poor and things like this. And I think nuclear weapons is a great example of that. So it's not only are we imperiling people economically so that somebody else can get rich, but we're imperiling their lives, and not only their lives, but the lives of future generations to come, far into the future, because this material that's used to produce the weapons can remain toxic for, tens of thousands of years. So we're literally imperiling hundreds of generations into the future, threatening life on this planet right now, and somebody's making money hand over fist, and I think that is an atrocious thing. So thanks for mentioning that. I think that's very much a part of the nuclear weapons conversation, is the fact that it is based in profit.
Absolutely. And, again, just to point out the, death cult-like nature of the weapons production, as you mentioned, from the moment the uranium is extracted, from the moment the nuclear material is extracted from the earth, there's illness and environmental devastation at that point. There's also often armed conflict and the fighting over the resources and, I would say, neo-colonialism, except really the neo part is superfluous. It's colonialism continuing in a resource exploitation. And so from the very beginning, it brings death and destruction. Then we manufacture weapons, which we hope we never use, but we can keep stockpiling them, apparently. And again, we have more than enough to ruin the planet already produced, but now we're looking at producing more, or we continue to produce more. Then, if in the best case scenario, they're not used in acts of war, they slowly leak their poisons into the planet, into the groundwater systems, into the rivers and the soils forever. So, or at least tens of thousands of years.
Right. And I think, I think that's particularly relevant to our audience here in Portland. And thanks so much to everyone who's listening to the show today. That reminds me of, we were speaking earlier about the Hanford Nuclear mm-hmm. Reservation, which is up in Richland, Washington, just a few hours from Portland on the Columbia River. This is where a lot of the material for nuclear weapons production happened all through the Cold War. It's actually also where the material for the bomb dropped on Nagasaki was produced. So that was 4 hours from Portland. It's currently the most contaminated place in the Western Hemisphere. It's one of the largest and most expensive, if not the largest and most expensive cleanup project, environmental remediation project in the world. So we're spending a lot of money dealing with the problems that we created 73 years ago, actually 75 years ago, mm-hmm. or early in that process. And so we can see that not only, of course, did we, have this very deleterious effect on the people of Japan at Hiroshima and Nagasaki, all through the Pacific where the testing happened, which we'll be talking about on Monday, August 6th, at our Facing America's Nuclear Legacy event, but also here in our own region. I think it's a really important thing to realize the sort of local connection that we have, particularly particularly to Nagasaki, the bombing of Nagasaki, that was made here or in Richland, very close to here. So I think we have, as a region, we have a special responsibility to work towards nuclear weapons abolition because we're one of the areas that actually produce one of the two weapons that were used in combat. And of course, here we are 73 years later, Hanford is leaking into the groundwater, it's leaking into the Columbia, tons of money being spent to clean it up. Again, some of the same corporations, those same big war profiteers that were involved in the production, it's kind of taking money out of both of your pockets. It's like, oh, we made these horrible things and it cost you, you know, billions of dollars. It made this huge environmental disaster, so I'm going to reach into your other pocket, take more of your taxpayer money to clean it up. Mm-hmm. So I think it's a, you know, it's a very sort of pernicious example of capital, you know, imperiling people for generations. So certainly our role as a nuclear abolition movement is to put, you know, to curtail this, to put a stop to this, to stop seeing people make profit on death and destruction and the very real and growing threat of cultural annihilation around the globe.
Yep. That's, yeah, the very real and growing threat of nuclear annihilation. That's, just think about that as we talk to Dougie. Good morning, Dougie. You're our next caller. You're on the air.
Hey, great conversation. Can you hear me?
Yes.
I really relate to your point when you were bringing up in the 80s, the Reagan era. And I can't remember the name of that movie. There was this that movie that came out in the 80s. The
War Games. Well, I don't know which movie you're talking about.
Well, it was a movie about nuclear war.
Yeah, there were a few.
And, well, I just bring that up because I remember that people were more tense about the threat of nuclear war, and then with the Cold War, as you said, Cold War ended, people kind of relaxed. But I know the doomsday clock has moved up. We have the irresponsibility of Trump, and the only reason that Trump could make a threat to North Korea is a lot of part of the racism and white supremacy and fascism that went into the same type of decision with Japan, but I just wanted to get your comment on what do you think it is about the American psyche of when you tell people about the possibility of the threat of nuclear war or the existential threats that we face with climate change, that there still seems to be this disconnect, like this isn't going to happen to me, or the permafrost isn't going to melt, or the oceans aren't going to die.
Yeah, it's like the screen of denial just sort of rolls slowly down there. You know, you can see their eyes have the sort of screen come in front of it and just be like, nope, can't think about that. Too big. Look over there. I think, where do you want to go do lunch today? You know, it's, I think there are some things that are too big for a lot of people to think about. And that's a huge problem. What do you think?
Is it religion? Is it in some ways, let's say that some of these evangelical Christians almost are anticipating an apocalyptic doom in our future, as if that's what they believe that's what God wants. He wants us all to, you know, destroy ourselves. And
Armageddon is coming, that sort of thing. Yeah.
It's all a part of God's plan.
It's an interesting question, Dougie. Hold on just a second. Sean, what do you think?
Well, Dougie, I think you bring up a couple of really interesting points. I think there's something deep in, I would say, particularly the human male brain that is self-destructive. And I think when we have that same self-destructive tendency that the individual tends to sublimate into, you know, more positive social interactions, oftentimes that self-destructive tendency, if it's writ large, on the cultural scene, we have things like nuclear weapons and you know, climate destabilization and things like this. So I think there is something in the human brain that sort of counterintuitively desires its own destruction. So that's a much broader topic, and that's some real depth psychology. But there are a couple of other points that I wanted to just touch on. I think there is certainly in the evangelical community there, I've seen sometimes this apocalyptic vision. I don't think it's certainly not all evangelical Christians, but there does seem to be a trend of lack of respect for the earth, you know, a lack of concern for nuclear weapons and climate change and things like this. And I think part of it does go back to that idea that we live in a flawed world, and once this world is destroyed, there'll be a better world in the future. And I think it's a very dangerous mythology. The other thing that I wanted to touch on that you mentioned was the racism element of it, and I think that's a very, very strong one. Racism was used very heavily in selling the bombing of Hiroshima and Nagasaki to the American people. You remember the sort of yellow fever, the fear of the fear of the Japanese, and there are these sort of subhuman caricature of a very rich and vibrant ancient culture. We see this too in the Pacific Islands, where the Pacific Islanders, we wouldn't have bombed those islands had they been predominantly white. I don't think we would have ever tested in that region. So both the use at Hiroshima and Nagasaki, again, where the uranium first comes from, is almost exclusively indigenous communities, in Australia and Canada and in Africa, which does, of course, fuel conflict there. So there's a very strong racist element to nuclear weapons. I think that's certainly something worth exploring and talking to people about and looking at the history of nuclear weapons and the development of nuclear weapons. And, I meant to kind of put it even out, to even go a little bit deeper. I think a lot of these weapons, in their early stages of development, we were bringing over Nazi scientists. So I don't think there, I think there's a connection there too, to help, actually develop our nuclear weapons program. So there's a very strong, long strain of racism in the history of nuclear weapons that persists to this day. I don't think you hear a lot of conversations about, bombing a predominantly white country with whom we have a disagreement. But if it's North Korea, sure. They're not white. So I think it's a little, it's easier to sell it to a white supremacist culture, which I think America most certainly is a white supremacist culture. So I think it's easier to sell that that death and destruction if the people on the other end look different than we do.
Can I bring up one more point?
Yeah, go ahead, and then.
Noam Chomsky sometimes talks about several different times where there's been close to nuclear launches. Could you talk about briefly that type of scenario, and then also the technology of these weapons has increased obviously over the past 75 years. A lot of people kind of remember or have seen the films of the radiation that happened in Hiroshima and Nagasaki, and the people who did survive the absolute horror of that. Could you talk about just the scenario if a launch was to go off? What we could anticipate, like with the nuclear winter and all that, those type of scenarios.
Thanks very much for your call, Dougie.
Sure, Dougie. Yeah, absolutely. So it's certainly true that nuclear weapons are far more powerful and far more destructive than the ones that were dropped on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. We're talking, 10 times stronger, sometimes more than that. So these are weapons that are capable of inflicting enormous damage. And again, these weapons are designed to target civilian population centers. They're not really designed to be used in active combat. They're designed to hit cities where they can do the maximum damage. They're designed to set cities on fire and kill humans, and that's the only thing they're designed to do. And they are far more powerful. There's a really great report that PSR, Physicians for Social Responsibility, our sort of national organization, put out a few years ago called Nuclear Famine, 2 billion People at Risk. And so the idea of nuclear famine is after the bombing, there's going to be a change in the upper atmosphere, dust being kicked up. It's going to have a massive influence or massive negative impact on global food production and distribution routes and all these other things. So that report, 2 billion People at Risk, looks at the idea of a so-called limited nuclear exchange. I think the example they use is between India and Pakistan, and the numbers that report sort of lay out show that even in a so-called limited nuclear exchange between two of the using smaller bombs even, we're talking about a disruption in the global food supply that would likely lead to 2 billion humans dying. And I think the death of 2 billion humans, we're talking about a collapse of most of our civilization, most of what it's taken us all these years to produce, and our arts and our philosophies and our mathematics and our understanding of reality are very much, you know, at risk because of nuclear weapons and you know, this adventure that humanity is on for all of its ups and downs, I think, would come to a grinding halt. And we can see this, you know, we can see what happened in the aftermath of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. It was not pretty. What happened after the bombings, I mean, not just the radiation sickness and things like this, but the cultural fracturing that happened to people in the Pacific Islands as well, where, you know, when you're displaced from your ancestral homelands, forcibly, you know, saying, you know, you can't stay here because we're going to bomb this island off the map. You know, certainly the sort of crime and all the other starvation and sickness and all the other things that happened at Hiroshima and Nagasaki, these are the predictable and natural effects of nuclear weapons. So as these weapons have grown in their destructive capability, I think that makes it even more than ever incumbent upon people, and I mean people listening to this show, to learn how we can get involved in the nuclear weapons abolition. And I'll just plug it and say you can visit www.OregonPSR.org. PSR for Physicians for Social Responsibility.org and find out how to get a little bit more involved. We've got a petition on there, two Oregon's elected representatives asking them to take more brave steps towards nuclear abolition, to put pressure on the federal government to sign on to the UN's nuclear weapons ban treaty. So there are actions that people can take. It's a sad and horrible situation, but there are things that we can do to make things better, and I encourage everyone to get involved and do that. A great way to do that or to learn about doing that is to come to our event on Monday.
And let's go back and talk about the event on Monday, the where and the when. And there's two events, is that right?
There's two, yeah. So great. So Oregon PSR and a coalition of really, really great, amazing other organizations, peace and justice organizations, Japanese and Japanese American cultural groups, communities of faith, and a lot of other groups have come together to organize the event that we're calling Facing America's Nuclear Legacy, Hiroshima, Nagasaki, and the Pacific Islands. That's going to be on Monday at 6 o'clock, from 6 to 7, at the Japanese American Historical Plaza, which is down on the Portland waterfront at Cooch Street, so just up from the Burnside Bridge. Again, from 6 to 7, and then immediately after our event there, where we'll have speakers, we'll have folks from the Pacific Islands, we'll have performance groups, or we're going to have taiko groups performing. It's going to be, you know, both entertaining and informative, and, you know, somber in the sense that we want people to really remember Hiroshima and Nagasaki and pay homage to the victims of nuclear weapons, and use that feeling of compassion for the lives that were lost there and in the Pacific Islands through all the years of testing, to use that sense of that emotional impact of that to then encourage our audience to get more involved in the nuclear weapons abolition work that we're doing. So that's going to be great. And then following our event, immediately after our event, we're going to have a procession to a building right up the street, sort of right around the corner, less than half a block away, for an event called Children Remember. Children Remember is a fascinating project that was developed by my good friend Yukio Kawano, who is a third generation Hibakusha. Hibakusha is a survivor of the atomic bombings, and in collaboration with Chizal Hata, who's actually an Oregon PSR advisory board member and another good friend. So Children Remember is a collaboration between high school students in Hiroshima having conversations, a year-long conversation with Hibakusha, with the atomic bomb survivors. So it's really bringing that you know, those older folks who are, you know, in their 70s, having conversations with teenagers, with high schoolers. The result of this were a series of art paintings that were basically the high school students' interpretation of the story that they got from speaking through this year-long conversation with the Hibakusha. So we're going to have that Children Remember event there with printings of some of the paintings, some performance pieces of some of the students' thoughts on this. And again, that's immediately going to follow our event around, probably starting around 7:15 at the Oregon College of Oriental Medicine's building at 75 Northwest Cooch. But we'll be having a procession from the Facing America's Nuclear Legacy event over to the Children Remember event. We're very excited for both of those.
All right. And let's go ahead and talk to David. Good morning, David. You're on the air.
Yeah, morning. I'm calling you from down in San Francisco. And as you were talking about the South Sea Islanders, how they were affected by the nuclear waste, here in San Francisco, we've got Hunter's Point, which is where, after they blew off the bombs, they brought the U.S. ships back to be sandblasted and cleaned after being exposed to radiation with those various explosions. And they just dumped all of the radioactive lead paint and radioactive asbestos and whatnot into the bay. So, yeah, we've got huge cancer clusters 60, 70 years later. You know, I was wondering if your guest is familiar with what are called the Exxon Papers. The one of the earlier callers was asking about, you know, why would any government allow some of this insanity to be developed? The Exxon, are you familiar with the Exxon
Papers? I'm not.
No, please do.
Yeah, well, the when Rachel Carson wrote her book *Silent Spring* back in the early 1960s, Exxon actually believed her, and their board of directors were honest and did some attempts to remediate gasoline and clean up their act. But the board of directors almost entirely changed in the late 1970s, and did a 180, and instead of doing anything to clean up, they instead went about buying scientists, buying universities, doing everything that they could do to lobby the government to deny that global warming or pollution was a problem. Mm-hmm. And so the Exxon Papers were only released about 2 years ago after Freedom of Information Acts and lawsuits forced the release of them. And these millions of pages show that they willfully and actively were going out of their way to subvert science and leave us basically unprotected. So when you start looking at things like the high cost of medical care, the various epidemics, whether it's, you know, diabetes or heart disease or all sorts of different things like that, these are all directly related to either pollution or radiation. And the polluters should be paying the medical bills, but the medical bills are being jacked up by corrupt medical HMOs. Mm-hmm. At the same time, the average person is being denied medical care.
Gotcha.
With a political vengeance. So it's a triple whammy. And I urge you to study the Exxon Papers, and it gives you a big picture on just how bad it is.
Right. Well,
absolutely.
Hey, David, thank you so much for your call this morning.
Sure.
And the idea of corporations scuttling science in the interest of making more really obscenely huge profits is not a new concept, unfortunately. The idea that that those that fund the studies often get the results they desire, it sort of goes hand in glove, part and parcel with that.
Absolutely. And, you know, Oregon Physicians for Social Responsibility, a lot of the work that we do, we consider it the gravest threats to human health and survival. So nuclear weapons, climate change, mm-hmm. And then we've actually broadened out to work on things like gun violence and racial injustice and all these other things. We do see this very strong sort of profit this idea of making profit for people who, again, already have more money than they'll ever be able to spend is a persistent theme in all of these things. Mm-hmm. You know, so we are talking about, destabilizing our climate, threatening our civilization, threatening mm-hmm. our children, making it hard to go out to, you know, see a movie or go to church or go to school without worrying if you're going to get shot. And all of these things really do come back to the fact that somebody is making money off of them. And because we live in what is essentially a corporate oligarchy, mm-hmm. our political system is overly influenced, overly swayed by big money. So that makes it far more incumbent upon us. We have our work cut out for us as Americans. We have a deep moral responsibility to make things better, not only for the citizens of our own country, everyone in our country, whether they are documented or undocumented. Everyone in our country deserves to be healthy, deserves to be happy, and deserves to be prosperous. And I think we have far more than enough wealth to go around. But instead of actually taking that sort of social responsibility and that moral responsibility, we're seeing this uptick in corporations basically saying, well, we don't care about you. It's all about us. And that goes back to the sort of, you know, American idea of, you know, pull yourself up by your bootstraps, you know. And one thing that it always occurs to me is it's hard to pull yourself up by your bootstraps if you don't have any boots. I think that's a thing that is facing a lot of Americans right now. And to me, it is. It's a grotesque situation where we have, you know, children in our own country starving or not even being able to drink water in their community. Mm-hmm. And we're spending trillions of dollars on weapons that, best case scenario, again, we never use. Worst case scenario, we use and wipe out human civilization. So to me, there's a clear path forward, and it is in strengthening democratic institutions. It is in taking the power of material wealth out of our political system. Unfortunately, we are going in that opposite direction, certainly under the current administration, which is very, I would say, a vulture capitalist, essentially, very parasitic and a threat to humanity. And I think, both through climate change and nuclear weapons and all these other issues that I just discussed, I think really the responsibility at the end of the day comes back to us, to the people who are listening to the show right now. There's something that we've got to do about this. We aren't as powerless as the man would have us believe. We just have to get off of our couches, and we have to get out into the streets, and we have to let our elected representatives know what we care about, and we have to put pressure on them as often as we can and as eloquently as we can to live up to their responsibilities and make this world the better place that it should be and deserves to be for all humans.
Yeah, that sounds good. Let's talk to Edie. Good morning, Edie. You're on the air.
Can you hear me?
Yeah. Hi, Edie.
When I was in Japan in 85, my Japanese host told me that before of Hiroshima, that Japan had formally surrendered 32 times via messages to the Soviet Union and India. They even went through China to Americans, and the American embassies and secretaries of state, et cetera, were saying that they couldn't do it yet. And that my husband, who was working for NASA, much older than I, said that they needed to have a weapons demonstration, just mm-hmm. like Gaza and the West Bank is, and what we do to Native Americans and other places are weapons demonstrations to increase weapon sales.
Mm-hmm.
32 times formally surrendered, 32 times.
Yeah, Edie, thank you so much for your call and making that point this morning.
Yeah, it is absolutely true that, again, that's countering that narrative or what I would call that mythology of a necessary evil. Right, even during the war, we look back at some of the historical record and we see that a lot of the people involved knew that this wasn't about ending the war with Japan. It was about intimidating Russia and the Soviet Union and showing the world that there was a new sort of superpower on the block, a superpower that could annihilate entire civilizations with a push of a button. And I think here we are 73 years later, and we're still dealing with that same threat, that same sort of shadow that has hung over us for so long. It's absolutely essential for us, I think, to understand that that is not true, that it is a mythology, that this was something that was necessary, something that we had to do. That is simply not true. So thanks for bringing that point up.
All right, with just 2 minutes left, how do people get involved? We haven't even gotten into the idea of the new plans for building a new low-yield variant warhead. That's in the works from this administration. We haven't gotten really even to scratch the surface of so much. How can people get involved, make a difference, and find out more?
Okay. Well, I would encourage people, again, I mean, I've mentioned it a few times, but we would love to see you down at the Portland waterfront on Monday at 6 o'clock for Facing America's Nuclear Legacy. You can find out about that at OregonPSR.org. That's Oregon PSR for Physicians for Social Responsibility. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter and Instagram and other places. But come to that event on Monday. Learn more about Hiroshima, Nagasaki, and the Pacific Islands. Learn more about what's going on in North Korea, that situation now, and take action. We have a petition to Oregon's elected representatives, to our senators and our representatives in the House, asking them to cut funding for nuclear weapons, to take real steps towards nuclear weapons abolition, and to encourage the federal government to sign on to the UN Nuclear Weapons Ban Treaty. So there are a few concrete steps that we can take, but I would just encourage anyone who's interested in seeing a nuclear-free future to, I would say, the only solution to it is to get involved. If you care about these things, put your money where your mouth is. Get involved. Get involved in the organizations like Oregon PSR and the other great organizations, ICANN, and tons of others that are doing great work. I would say here locally, Oregon PSR is a great organization to get involved in because we're really doing on-the-ground work for nuclear weapons abolition. And we certainly hope to see you on Monday at 6 o'clock at the Japanese American Historical Plaza.
All right. Well, Sean Tenney, Associate Director of Oregon PSR, thank you so much for taking the time to join us this morning here at KBOO.
Thank you, Ani, and thanks so much to everyone who called in this morning.
Absolutely. We'll be back next week with more discussions, to decry what needs to be changed and to make that new world together. In the meantime, do take care. Stay tuned. There's a lot going on. Also coming up, something super positive. A week from tomorrow, August 11th, will be a huge block party celebrating KBOO's half century. That's right, KBOO turns 50 this year, and we are having our last huge public event to celebrate that fact from noon till 10 p.m. on Southeast 8th Avenue, one block south of the station. Station tours on an open house all day, live music in the street. You want to be there. That is August 11th, noon to 10 p.m. on Southeast 8th, KBOO's big block party for our 50th anniversary. Take care. Stay tuned for more coming up at 9 Pacific Underground.
This is KBOO Portland. The time now is 9 o'clock. Coming up this morning on KBOO, next on Pacific Underground, they get personal with T. Nu, owner of Project Object, about her family's hardships as refugees in America and her experience running a small business. At 10, Valley Views talks to the co-founder of the Corvallis chapter of SURJ, Showing Up for Racial Justice. At 10:15, it's Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein, and 11, it's a Radio Geekly with a discussion of non-binary characters in geekdom. All of these KBOO programs are made possible by your support. If you'd like to become a member, please go to kboo.fm and click on Donate.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Facing America's Nuclear Legacy, Hiroshima, Nagasaki, and the Pacific Islands, on Monday, August 6th at 6 p.m. at the Japanese American Historical Plaza in Portland. Facing America's Nuclear Legacy will remember the victims of the August 6th and August 9th, 1945 atomic bombings of Hiroshima and Nagasaki.